good discussion on the My Down Review. Me? I don't know what to think. There's a certain logic behind it. But maybe it raises problems at the same time as, you know, being plausible. So if you're trying to persuade somebody of the mind-only view, how would you persuade them? You know, what arguments are in his favour, first of all? Pardon? Madness. It's completely. Well, it's supposed to be a very good view for yogis to take. It's a yogic. Yogacara is another name for Chittamatra, isn't it? Yeah, we can say we have the appearances to mind of various things, but then to say that there is something out there which corresponds to that experience, that somehow that's kind of, you'd have to step outside of your own mind to show somebody, wouldn't you? That's all you're ever dealing with the appearances that you receive. So we have the mind taking on the aspect of a certain object, for instance, blue. But then to say there is a corresponding blue out there, so the mind's being just generated in the aspect of that object, well, that aspect is all you've got. No object apart from the aspect. You can't separate the two and experience them side by side and compare them, can you? You're only working through the aspects. But why does it have to be exterior? We say, oh, yes, there is matter, there's form, there are the flowers, there are seeds that produce flowers. But is that, do they have to be exterior? I'm not saying they are consciousness. I'm not saying blue is consciousness, literally. Yeah? So if blue is not external to the mind, is it just mind? And you might say, oh, is blue consciousness? I don't think the mind-only school are saying that, are they? What's wrong with saying, yes, blue is just mind, or table is just mind, and taking that literally? Yeah, well, the table would have to be clear and knowing, wouldn't it? The table would have to be conscious. The table would have to be something which takes on the appearance of objects and knows them. So we're not saying the table is just consciousness. But it's an appearance to consciousness, just like the appearance in a dream. So it's some kind of something on, I don't know, you say the surface of the mind or whatever. It's something within the mind. So I'd resist saying it's external. I mean, I haven't discussed this with Glenn or anything, and I'm not the world's expert on this topic, but that seems to me that's what they're denying. The Prasangikas aren't denying that. A prasangika is trying to say the thing is merely imputed by mind, but still it's external. They were trying to have the cake and eat it, you know. Or your pot is merely imputed by mind, but still it holds water, you know. So which seems, that seems to be like a, you know, bit of a contradiction. But that's not the mind only.
If everything is only mind, then I am the centre of my universe, and everything is appearing in my mind, then there is no basis for ethics. I mean, because it doesn't matter if it's a stream, it's only appearing in my mind, it's to behave or want to do.
Yeah, but if you go around just knocking people off and stealing from them, then you'll experience the experiences that arise to your mind will just get worse and worse. You go deeper and deeper into the, you know, the very dodgy, swampy areas of samsara, where suffering is acute. Exactly. So even though things are just appearances of the mind, it doesn't stop the being, you know, the play of karma. Do they? Well, in these reasons here on the paper, where did I get those from? Oh, that's from Maps of the Profound, I think, by Hopkins, you know, his section on mind only. He's got various input from different texts he's read on mind only, and I don't know who wrote that. Is it from, I think I got it from there. But it says three reasons by which mind onlyers defend their view that there are no external objects and consciousness exists inherently. The subject, waking consciousness, it does not have an external object because it is a consciousness, just like a dream consciousness. So they're making a very great similarity between dream consciousness and waking consciousness. Aren't they? Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying they're the same in all ways, not at all. There's this similarity. It's like when you say, "Oh, look, there's you can have a mirage. You can have the appearance of water without there actually being water there." For instance, when you have see the water of a mirage, you see. But yeah, one is still a correct consciousness when you see actual water and know it's water. And you look at the water of a mirage, and if you think that's water, then that's a wrong consciousness. So we're not saying that, you know, the consciousness seeing the water of a mirage and the consciousness seeing water are exactly the same in all respects. Yeah, one's a correct consciousness, one's a wrong consciousness. But they're similar in the sense that, you know, you can have appearances which don't depend upon external objects to back them up. So that's kind of the way they're trying to justify their view. You have the appearances of the mind without there being, without there needing to be some sort of external reality.
But I thought mind was the right thing that the same can't exceed from the object side of the mind, which is therefore, that suggests that there is something that arises from both sides. Otherwise it would just be dreaming.
Say that first bit again then. Well, I was doing this morning, wasn't I?
I took my glasses off.
So that's one seed dividing into two.
One seed and one becomes the non-dual. You've got the subject and the object together, and that one can't exceed.
So where's that seed to be found? Where is it stored, you know? Yeah, so that's, where's the kangaroo pouch, yeah?
Well, I suppose that would be your, really, my basis of all.
My basis of all? I'll lay a vision on it. Well, mind only seems to mean no external reality to me. So this karmic seed, which is on this mind basis of all, people positing that as some kind of repository consciousness. So all your other consciousnesses, like your eye consciousness or your ear consciousness, you know, they kind of, you know, arise from it at the same time as the object those eye consciousness and ear consciousnesses are looking at. So one seed in the repository in the kangaroo pouch, so the ripens up and sort of splits or appears to split into subject and object. So it's not like there's one seed from the side of the object or one seed from the side of the mind kind of meeting up, as if that's what you started off by saying. So,
yeah, so they come up together, but there is something wrong perceived as dual, separate.
Once it's ripened, yeah. So then it seems as if once that process has taken place, blue is different, distant from the eye consciousness seeing blue. But that's an illusion. So what's wrong with that? It's perfect. Do you think we can justify that as a view of reality? What's your name? Sorry, I've forgotten.
Me?
Yeah. What's your name? Sorry.
Antash.
Prasangika doesn't ultimately says that mind is not different, it's just exactly as other phenomena, like inherent existence. Whereas in mind only, there is a kind of sense, a small sense of superiority on inherent in the mind, which is rejected. And my feeling, let's say, is that. Where I feel a bit closer to Prasangika is that I feel that subject and object has a two-way relationship with each other, and that is very well expressed in Prasangika Madhyamika. So object affects subject and subject affects. So there is a two-way relationship, whereas in mind only I feel it a little bit a one-way or a kind of coming together. Because it's
one-sided, kind of, yeah.
Exactly. And that is what I feel is challenged or rejected in the Prasangika.
Yeah, so that's the that's quite well put, I think, yeah. So mind only is a bit more one-sided, so all the reality is with the mind, and you know, you can't find anything out there that you know, sustains conventional, you know, the external objects in the way they exist. So it all comes back to the mind. And Prasangika has tried to make it much more balanced, don't they? Object, observer depends upon the observed. Observed, it depends upon the observer. Which is, you know, quite subtle.
Yes.
So there's no sort of primordial ground, there's no sort of, you know, thing where nowhere that these things meet back to. So we can discuss that a bit more. Yeah. So that's good. But the Svatantrika grouping, you see, in the Yogacara Svatantrika Madhyamikas, they're sort of saying, ah, well, just as the object has no true existence, so the mind has no true existence either. So ultimately, on the ultimate level, object and subject, you know, equality. But the best way of presenting conventional truth, when you're dealing just on that level, you know, when you're dealing with your emotions or your, you know, the way to react to the world, deal with the, you know, the challenges that arise, it's best to see everything just as the appearances of mind, just like a dream, so that the best way to present conventional truth is still that it has no sort of... the best way to expect conventional kind of objects out there in the world is to say that they're not like that, they're just appearances to our minds. So you've got the, you know, the Yogacara Svatantrika kind of, you know, tweak there on top of just simple mind only. All of it.
Because you were just making a subtle distinction there between the mind only and the yogacara, the yams, as I'm now calling them. Yes.
The yams, yeah. The yams.
Can you just sort of like clarify that again, please?
Well, Artash was remarking that, you know, the prasangik have this sort of balance, like the observer depends on the observed depends on the observer, sort of an equality between subject and object. Neither one is more real than the other. Whereas the mind-only people say it all meets back to the mind. Yeah, so it all just depends upon mind. So we can devalue external reality, but still we've got to have something where it all meets back to, and that's the mind. So that's a bit one-sided. But the Yogacara Svatantrika Madhyamikas, you know, like the people who've mentioned here, Shantarakshita and Harivadra, so they're saying, yes, there is an equality of subject and object. So both are like true existence. So in that sense, an ultimate truth, we are with the Madhyamikas. But when it comes to positing conventional truth, it's still a more practical way of dealing with conventional truth to say that there are no external objects. So on conventional truth, it's still better to stick with mind only and saying there's nothing out there. It's just appearances to your mind. Your handle... dealing with conventional reality much better if you, you know, remember it's like that.
So they're saying conventionally that there are no external objects, but that ultimately
there's neither external object nor mind seeing it.
And the mind only is saying there's no external objects, but it works to be ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, we can look at the paper in a minute, maybe, like this, yeah. So it's better to go, you know, step by step, you know, it's like, mind only. Anybody else got anything in favour of that? Anything they came up with in their group? To say, yeah, that's a good view? Yeah, I think that's why people, Buddhists, like they're favouring the mind-only view, because it is, you know, if you want to explain karma, the working of karma, it's kind of easier, or it's very fitting anyway to have this mind-only view. So that makes it sort of easier to go along with the teachings on karma.
For us also, this basic concept of non-duality, that what we see depends on our mind, how we see it.
Mm.
It is a very easily understandable way to decrease attachments, because that's one of the main purpose of this teaching, to decrease attachments. And whereas in Prasangika Madhyamika, to understand non-inherent existence and all these things are rather complicated. Mm. We understand that when we see something that is basically the way we see it is internal to the mind. It is I find it a very an easier way to decrease attachment to those objects.
That's good, yeah. And I think that's exactly how people put forward the argument about mind only, yeah? That we all see things in different ways. To you it looks tremendously beautiful and worthwhile and you must have that object. To somebody else, they're quite indifferent to it. That flavour of that object means nothing to them, yeah? So it's like, you know, things appearing so differently to other people, to different people. Normally it's the same object, but they're all, you know, just responding to their own appearances of that object, subjectively. Yeah, so that's mind only explains that quite well. Yeah, and then, as you say, the step beyond that then is to say, yes, well, since it is just an appearance to my mind, due to my, you know, habitual past tendencies, you know, kind of ripening up, pushing up out of the mind basis four, then, you know, it decreases your emotional involvement or your unhealthy emotional involvement with it. You can let go of it or be more, sort of, you know, feel more detached about it. Anybody go around when there were children thinking, oh, the world is just like a dream that I might wake up from? Yeah, sort of some children perhaps like that. They have sort of some sort of sense of the unreality of the world, which might be a bit mind-only. So, one of the questions here then is, you know, if you start to say, well, what's the justification for the mind-only view? You can say, well, what is out there? If there is anything out there, what is it? If there's something that is a separate substance from the mind, what is it? So, you know, you can argue then, and this is what Bishop Berkeley is involved in. You know, are you going to posit things like tables, trees, kind of objects like that, rivers, are they going to be the things that are actually out there? They're the external objects? Or else are you going to posit, you know, you're going to find there's something suspect about that? And then you're going to go to what they call sensibilia. So it's just a sense impressions. So, okay, you know, there's the things that are just simple sense objects, like sort of blue, or I don't know, the smell of onions, or you know, something when you touch something, you know, the feel that it's got. So you know, like the example on the paper is chocolate, yeah. So the color of chocolate, that's externally existent, and then the taste of chocolate, okay, that's something that the chocolate gives you, and then you know the tangible object chocolate, that sort of smooth feel to it if you touch it, or sticky feel, whatever it is. You see, that's kind of externally existent. But putting them together and say, oh, now that's chocolate, that's, you know, by the power of the mind. So it's not the complex external object that's, the complex object that's external. But it's just those sense objects, those sense, you know, things that you receive through your different senses, and the complex object that comes united from them. That's kind of unreal. It's only those sense impressions that are real. So they're called sensibilia by some people. But then people start to question those, you see, and say, well, they're only made up of parts. You know, they're only made up of particles. So where are you going to find the actual, you know, object amongst all those particles? If you've got a mass of particles, where show us the actual object then? You know, if this patch of blue is made up of blue particles, all these blue particles, where's the actual patch of blue then? It isn't the first particle. It isn't the second particle. It isn't the third particle. It isn't the fourth particle. Yeah. So where is it? You know. Again, the mind is just cohering the particles to make an object. So that's the mind doing that work, and it isn't there from the side of the object. That's your mind sort of involving with the particles and making something of them, which isn't in them naturally. So then, it's the tiny particles, they're reality. Huh? The tiny particles, they're the real things. Yeah? Just like you've got to sort of work in there, find out the object, something which is the object from the object's own side, you know, something which bears analysis. Yeah? Something which stands up to analysis, which is there, whether the play of the mind is going on or not. So is that just about these tiny particles and the partless particles? So that's the kind of argument that goes on. So what is there? And people like Bishop Berkeley say, well, you know, it's obvious then when you go into those analysis that, you know, all you've got is these impressions to mind and there's nothing you can work on. You know, there's the basis out there which establishes the object from its side, whether it's a complex object or a small particle. So then that's how people are trying to persuade you of the mind-only view. So the lower schools, you know, they're ending up with saying, yeah, okay, you can say this complex object is just something that's sort of imputed by the mind, you know, or this sort of patch of something fairly homogenous, like blue, you can say, well, in the end, that's imputed by the mind. It's the mind which is gathering together and saying that's a patch of blue and not just a load of small little dots. It's the mind that's making those dots into a patch. So then, that just leaves the partless particle, and so they try to stop there. So there's a particle that's so small that it can't be broken up anymore. So this is something that they take as, you know, if they're trying to find ultimate truth, something which stands up to analysis, then that's a kind of thing that there might be, you know, that's our last resort, okay? But they are really there, the partless particles. Or even the each moment of the partless particle. If you start bringing time in, you see, then you can say, but each moment is changing, each moment is becoming something different from what it was. Each moment it passes out of existence and another particle arises which just looks similar to the last one. You know, that's subtle impermanence, isn't it? So even just the point, the instant of the point, tiny particle. So that's somehow, your analysis can't go beyond there, you see? So once you can do that, then you can build up an externally existent world on the basis of those particles. Everything's made of these particles, yeah? So that's why they look like the eye. You know, wood looks like wood because it's made of wood particles, you know? And so on. So that they're trying to sort of, you know, find, let's say, an essence, or they're trying to find a ground where things arise from. Yeah? What's your ultimate ground? You know, what's your ultimate justification for your view? So then the mind-only people are coming along and say, there's no such thing as a partless part. That's just your wishful thinking. So you've got to go to the mind-only people. Has anybody got the timetable?
I have. Ah, we got to 3:30 then for this session. Good. Yeah. So how do the mind-only people refute the partless particle? Yeah. Okay. So how do they refute it? With irrefutable logic. Yeah. So, however small the particle, the lower schools come up with, the mind-only people just say, oh yeah, okay, so let's say this particle is surrounded by a bunch of other particles. You know, that's how they exist, isn't it, in bunches. So you've got one in the middle there, and then you could have, like Stuart says, you could have one on the left, another small particle on the left, another small particle on the right, if you had three in a row. So this one in the middle then, wouldn't it have a part, one part of it would have to be near to this one. So for you that would be the left-hand side of this particle, would be near to this particle. And then the right-hand side of this particle would be near to this particle. Yeah? So then this particle has got two parts. It's got a left side and a right side. So we're not saying, oh, you can cut it up and chop it into two. Okay, it might be too small because our knives aren't that, not kind of thin enough to cut it up. But it doesn't matter. It's still got parts, right? It's still got a left side and a right side. See what I mean? And somebody could say, well, no, this particle is so small, it doesn't have one part that is nearer to this, one part that is nearer to that. So then what would you say to that, Stuart? It's so small that it doesn't have one part, a right side and a left side.
So then that means that an angry particle can't touch it, because there's nothing for it to touch.
Well, some of these vibhasikas, they say the particles don't touch. There's space between them, gaps. Yeah, somebody said it's so small that there isn't such thing as one part of it which is near to this one and one part which is near to that one. So what would you say to that?
So how could we build things if things don't touch?
Well, they exert forces, you know. There's magnetic force and electronic force, and, you know. Atoms are mostly empty space, aren't they? Even in modern physicists thinking.
Yeah. Atoms are made of other things.
Yeah, but the things are very distant, spread out, aren't they? But still they make very strong materials like iron or steel and stuff. Yeah. But if you had a particle that didn't have a right side nearer to this particle or a left side nearer to that particle, then what would happen to it? It would have to disappear, wouldn't it? You know, as soon as it's got any size at all, even the very smallest size, surely it must have, you know, it must be like near to that one on that side and near to this one on this side. Don't you think? Yeah, if you try to imagine it disappearing, then okay, then we wouldn't say right side, left side. But as soon as it's even just has even a tiny appearance, tiny dimension, then it's got to sort of, and if it's in between these other two particles, then, you know, it's got to have one side nearer this particle, one side further away from that particle, hasn't it? So that's how these are the mind-only school and upper school, higher schools, they reject the partless particle. You see, so then you've got, when you look for blue on the side of the object, or, you know, potato on the side of potato, then you don't find anything. There's nothing you can come up with. If these particles are just smaller and smaller and smaller, you know, there's nothing there from the object side which resists your analysis. So that's the kind of thing they seem to be saying. So how do we know it's blue then? Yeah? If when we look on the side of the object blue, we don't find blue, then what are you going to do next? So that's when the mind-only people say yes. So where blue gets justified from is from the mind. So blue is just an appearance to mind, so how do you know that's a valid mind? Well, you have to look at the mind. You don't look at the object to see whether it's ultimately blue or not. But see, it doesn't sort of, there's nothing there to resist your analysis. So it's from the mind side that you decide whether it's blue or not. So, you know, the ground of being or the grounding of reality is all from the mind side. So I don't know how much sense that makes, but that's kind of the mind-only approach, isn't it? That's what the kind of thing they're saying. Pardon? Well, I think merely labelled as saying there isn't any independent reality about blue at all. You know, if you look, wherever you look, you don't find anything that really is blue by way of its own qualities, you know, by way of its own characteristics. So then we have to say blue is merely labelled. Blue is merely sort of a participatory. Merely causes a dependent arising. There's nowhere to find it at all, but in reality. So that's that's a sort of very powerful, sort of a devastating critique. But the people below the brass aggregates, they're always trying to find somewhere where it really does exist. Okay, so it doesn't. You can't say it really does exist outside. Because, you know, there's nothing that we find when we search among those particles. We don't find anything that really is there. How can you find the pot amongst its parts? They understand that, you know. You don't find the pot amongst its parts. And there's no pot sort of separate from the parts, like some of these outsider schools try to claim. You know, the whole is somehow there, kind of, you know, in addition to the parts and sort of a separate substance of the parts. So there's nothing there. So then, but they say, yes, but it's really there because there's a mind seeing it there, you know. And so the justification for pot, it comes back to the mind. Yeah. So there's this causal seed arising, you know, from within the mind basis of all the subtle mental consciousness, coming up, and you know, it's splitting into two: a mind seeing pot and pot, you know, a mind seeing blue and blue. So when you trace where there's a blue coming from, it's coming from the seed. And so it's like the mind is where the justification is coming from. The mind is where the kind of reality of blue is coming from. And they even talk about these self-cognizers, don't they? You know, we've discussed those in awareness and knowledge. So how do you know that the mind is a correct mind then? How do you know that mind seeing blue is a valid mind? So then there's this self-cognizer checking up on the mind. So there's a mind looks out at blue, it sees blue, and then there's this self-cognizing element of consciousness, according to mind-only school. And that is sort of checking up on the mind seeing blue, and that knows that the mind seeing blue is a valid mind, you see. So self-cognizers, these self-knowers come into the mind-only presentation, so that they're kind of, you know, validating the object by validating the consciousness knowing the object, and how they're doing that. This self-knowing direct perceiver, which is going along with the sense direct perceiver. So that seems to be a bit how, these logicians like Dharmakirti are kind of playing it. That they, you know, a lot of time Dharmakirti in his works on cognition is working on the level of Satrantika, where there are external objects. But then when he's pressed on the issue, then his own personal, you know, final view seems to be that you have to give up the being the reality of external objects. Just accept as mind and its appearances. So Dharmakirti ends up being in the mind-only school, along with Asanga and Vasubandhu, those proponents. Anybody actually like the mind-only view? Think it's a good one? Good. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got some sort of people with high reputations on your side here. Dhammakirti, Vasubandhu, Asanga. They're all in your camp. Yeah. But if you start trying to attack the mind-only view, you can also we'll work from that side. Because everybody did come up from some good arguments where they think the mind-only view has weaknesses. I mean, you might not like it, it doesn't sort of suit my, you know, way I like to look at the world, or you might say, yeah, it is, that's a good point. And I often used to think like that, you know. But if you're trying to sort of undermine it or criticize it, any lines of doubt you could cast on it?
They seem to be keen to refute us if substantially exists himself and external phenomena.
Mm.
But they're still happy to posit substantially existent mind or consciousness.
Yeah. There's got to be something existing. We arise, we're born, we suffer, you know, we long to be free from suffering. So there's something involved in this sort of, you know, a kind of, you know, challenge we're in, this complications. But if we dream up all these foolish appearances, you know, that's kind of, compulsive and addictive, and, you know, we'd be going on, goes on and on and on. But, you know, maybe we can clear away, you know, make the sort of purity of our mind manifest. But there's still got to be a mind that becomes pure, isn't it? There's got to be something which reaches that state of freedom. So unless you have the mind really existing, then it seems like you are going nowhere. You'll end up in nihilism. Like the Prasangikas. But is that the final nature, that, you know, the mind is there, radiant, non-dual with its own emptiness or something? You know, the Buddhahood would be like that for these mind-only people. So the mind is there, completely free of all these pesky, irritating appearances of suffering and kind of, you know, clumsy objects. So the mind is just radiantly there, non-dual with its own emptiness. That's sort of a funny thought. But this must be how the mind only is kind of thought in a way. Yes, the mind and its own emptiness are non-dual. But how would that be? One's a functioning thing, you know. One is an impermanent one, and the emptiness is the mere absence of all, you know, these proliferations and external objects, different substances. But that's a mere absence somehow. That's a, you know, non-affirming negative. The absence of all these sort of, you know. Yeah, previously kind of, you know, distorted appearances and so on. Non-dual mind, yeah. That's a good one, that. So is there anything to criticize it? Knock the mind only down. Not sophisticated enough. Well, let's have a cup of tea. And then we can try and meditate on it a bit, you know. It's supposed to be one for meditation. We'll read some words from Shantarakshita. Can't answer any more questions. But we should do a bit of meditation, last session. Okay. Time for a break.